If your family business survived the French Revolution, a common or garden recession ought to be a breeze, or so you'd think. The French group Wendel has been around for more than 300 years. It used to make steel. Nowadays, it invests in various businesses, including the construction group Saint-Gobain. It's probably one of the longest-lived companies in the world, maybe because generation after generation, it's had the stability of the family behind it. However, family businesses have a drawback, relative squabble. And Wendel has had a turbulent time recently, with a family feud over the direction of the business, concerns about levels of debt, and a loss of $1,400 million this year. The most prominent member of the family is the French business leader and baron, Ernest-Antoine Selyer. I asked him what sort of benefits family ownership can bring.
Well, I think one of the main aspects is that it is very long-term minded. It's not trying to make capital gains over the year or even over a few years. It has a more, if I may say, a generation outlook. And so it tries to build assets and develop in a company, not looking at day after day results, but really looking at building up and developing a strong, a very strong actor. And I think everybody recognizes that a family company is, for that reason, strategically probably better positioned than the companies where both the managers and the shareholders are looking for, if I may say, quick money. So this is one of the main pluses.
Let me ask you about how many recessions you think the company has lived through.
Oh, well, I mean, when at first it went through the French Revolution, and then it went through all the difficulties that we've had, as you know, on the boundaries between France and Germany, because the company was located in Lorraine, which is a province east of France, and it's been the matter of disputes between France and Germany for about a century. And I don't believe that a normal company would have survived all this if there was not the very deep attachment to the location, to the past, to the role of the family. And the employees and the workers, of course, also extremely close to the company, with what we have called sometimes paternalism, which is, you know, taking care of the workers even before there was a social security program. So the togetherness of the shareholders, the family, the workers, the province and the place itself was extremely strong. And I think all this played a large role in helping the family to keep on generation after generation.
Now, you've painted a pretty rosy picture about the pluses of having a large family-controlled business. What about the minuses?
Well, the minuses, which are more or less always underlined, is the fact that if you want to keep a family management, for what reason should the son or the daughter today of a family be better than others in order to take the management of the company and push it forward? And this is the main criticism that is usually done. The second weakness is in the capacity for the shareholders to keep united and all stick together also in order to support a strategy. And most of family businesses at some point have the end of their family life because of the quarrels that happened. More or less, I would say, at the second or third generation, more than at the tenth.
Well, Wendel is having problems right now, isn't it? Over the last couple of years, 900 family members have been in dispute over the allocation of shares. In fact, it's been called an internal guerrilla warfare.
Well, this is true that we've had the difficulty. Myself being in control of the company as manager for some 30 years, I have been supported by the family through difficult times at some point with no problem. And then it happened that we had, you know, when it happens in a family, that you have one person which for some reason or another attacks everyone and so on. And this has been, of course, the cause of some trouble. and there was a lot of mediatic row. But this is now over. It's interesting for the medias when there's a kind of family saga that goes on and some trouble occurs.
Now, Vandel has lived through all these upheavals of 300 years and recessions. But, of course, things are not great, are they? There was a huge loss announced at the end of August this year, $1,400 million. Can the company survive that?
We have, of course, faced difficulty because we've bought a large chunk of the shares of Saint-Gobain, the very large international company, French international company, and just before the subprime crisis. And so the value of our Saint-Gobain shares that we bought has been dropping dramatically, and for that reason we have to come out with a loss in the company, but it is called a loss on paper, and it would be a real loss if we had divested, but we have not divested, and for that reason we expect that the Saint-Gobain shares that we've bought will be developing in its value over the years.
Ernest Antoine Cellier. Well, do family businesses across the world look the same? Do they suffer the same problems of infighting, spats over strategy and succession? And do they enjoy the same longevity? Well, the Vandel family gave money to the INSEAD Business School to start an international centre for family enterprise, founded by Professor Randall Carlock to research some of these issues and to help individual businesses in different regions. I asked him why this particular sort of business model is worth studying.
Family business is the oldest form of economic organization, but throughout the world, it's the dominant form. If you go to Europe, continental Europe particularly, it's 70 or 80% of all the businesses. You go to Italy, it's 95%. The Middle East, it's 100%. Asia, it's 100%. Even in the United States, it's 40-plus percent. And so family business is a fundamental way we organize.
We've heard from Ernest Antoine Cellier about some of the problems. I mean, there are arguments within families which create huge rifts.
There are huge arguments, and that's one of the dilemmas. That's the challenge of family business. It's the overlap of the two most important elements in our lives, our work and our love. And when these two intersect, we can have huge conflicts, and it's so damaging. And so one of the reasons that I studied to become a family and marriage therapist is so I could work with families. No one knows more about the conflict in families than I do, and it's a critical, critical issue.
So you look at these businesses almost as clients, like you would do as a therapist.
We very much you look at them as you would look at as a therapist or as a coach or as a teacher. I mean, it's a wide range of skills you have to bring to the family. You know, families are our fundamental activity in our lives. And so when the business is mixed with it, we have to be very careful to make sure we protect the family. So when I look at a family business, my first concern is not the business. It's the family. You can get another business. You can't get another family.
So are you really saying that all families have both good and bad in them?
Of course. Of course. There's no family that doesn't have conflict.
And that affects the business.
Of course it can affect the business. And so we have to be very careful to create boundaries and controls so that the business is protected. And then we're going to make sure that our employees and that everyone that's a part of this business lives by a set of values. There's a reason that you haven't seen the private family banks be destroyed by this economic crisis. You look at all the large private banks competing in the same market as UBS, but they didn't take these high-risk ventures because families owned them and they were prudent in how they invested their clients' money. And so they're much stronger position.
But now, are there some cultures where they don't really want to codify the rules effectively, the governance of how the family business should work? I mean, there must be some parts of the world where it goes against the culture to do that.
Well, it doesn't necessarily go against the culture. You have to be adaptable. For example, a board of directors. A board of directors in the West is about professionalism. We want the most talented management people we can find. A board of directors in the Middle East is much more about maintaining harmony. You have blended families, and you have a different mentality. And so you'll have key people on the board who are there to help the family and the business work together. In Asia, it's about seniority. It's about who's the most respected. And so you'll have a senior team that might be on the board. And so each of these are different, but the function is the same. It's to make decisions and it's to provide accountability. And if we can teach the family those two key activities, it doesn't matter to me who's on the board. It's more important what they do.
Now, you tell me that you're going out to do workshops in the Middle East and then in Asia. What are the differences between the kind of thing that you'll be doing with families and family businesses in those two areas?
Practically none. Now, you just look surprised at me. And the reason you did is because you're saying to yourself, and this is it's our assumption, that there's very big differences between Asia, the West, the Middle East. And there are cultural differences. But fundamentally, the most important thing to all cultures is their children and their families. And so what we have to do is help the families in the context of their culture, whether it's Sharia or Confucianism, we have to help them create mechanisms that work in their culture. But the issues are the same. The issues are succession, control, careers, values, and what do we do with the money? Because money's a big one. And let's not forget it. The reason that family businesses are so popular in movies and in soap operas is because money is a big issue and recognition's a big issue.
I guess a lot of the families that you're talking to have lost, what, a quarter, as much of a third of their wealth in the last couple of years because of the crisis. I mean, a lot of them must have seen the reserves of the business, as it were, drain away.
Well, but family businesses are in it for the long term. And so what happens over a period of 12 months or 24 months isn't that significant. I mean, I'll tell a story that Andrew Waits from the Waits Group here in London shared with me at lunch the other day. We were talking about the business, and he said, sure, business is tough.
What does the Waits Group do?
The Waits Group is a large construction company. They build churches and hospitals, and they're most famous. One of the things that I'm most proud of being associated with them is that they did the remodeling of St. Paul's Cathedral. But the Waits Group, Andrew is the chairman and has led the company for several years as the executive chairman. But he said to me, business can be tough and we may have some tough periods. But he said, our next generation is in place. He said, we've got great non-family managers in place and we've got a strong board of directors. He said, we're just starting after 150 years. So that's the kind of thinking that families represent. And that's the power of it. That's the difference than this mentality that you get in the city or on Wall Street of what's going to happen this afternoon and how big's my bonus going to be for this quarter.
Professor Randall Carlock from INSEAD. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Leslie Kerwin. How do you feel about getting praise at work? Personally, I'm rather surprised by it and it makes me blush bright red. Some of us need large dollops of praise all the time. But from the manager's point of view, how and when to dish out praise is one of the trickiest things to get right. Our regular commentator Lucy Kellaway of the Financial Times newspaper admits to being one of those people who can't get enough of the stuff.
I'm addicted to praise. If I don't get it, I go into a decline. If I do get it, I hold it up to the light to assess its quality, and if it passes muster, I experience a brief praise rush. But then I need more. Because my own appetite is insatiable, I assume that praise is the answer to every managerial problem, especially at this point in the economic cycle when no one can afford to reward people with more money. To reward them with generous handouts of "what a star" would seem a no-brainer. Yet praise is surprisingly difficult to get right, and even good praise loses its oomph if there's too much of it. As with all addictive substances, there's a level for safe use, after which it gets dangerous. 2 units of alcohol a day are deemed safe. 2 units of praise are far too many. If one gets praised every day, then one quickly stops experiencing any rush, yet any reduction in the dosage leaves one feeling demotivated and wretched. The correct praise dosage is gender-dependent, as it is with alcohol. Men tend to take all praise at face value, and so are sustained by less. Women reject half the praise as being insincere or misdirected or offensive, so need more to get by on. It's not just the quantity of the praise, but also the quality that's hard to get right. There are 3 pieces of advice commonly given to managers to make their praise more effective, but all are terrible. The first says that praise must be public. This is downright irresponsible. while it's never certain that praise will make the praisee feel any better, it's always certain that public praise will inflict heavy collateral damage on everyone else who hears it. Praise is also supposed to be specific. Again, this is catastrophically poor advice, as the detail chosen by the praiser may not be the thing that the praisee wishes to be commended for. A friend tells me that she was recently praised for her diligence, yet what she wanted to be praised for was creativity. Finally, the praiser is usually told to smile. This is also a bad idea. The point of good praise is that it must look deadly serious in order to seem sincere. If it comes from some grinning fool, one knows to disregard it altogether. As well as making praise private, broad, and serious, it helps if the praiser can slag off someone else at the same time. A colleague chillingly confides that the nicest thing his mother ever said to him was that he was brighter than his sister. Good praise, though, can be ruined in any number of ways. A surprise tone of voice wrecks it, while any hint of negativity, no matter how tiny, wipes out all the positive impact. The wisest oracle on praise was dog trainer Barbara Woodhouse, whose approach can easily be adapted for use with humans. She argued that dogs do not mind which words you use, it's the tone of voice that counts. So if you say rhubarb, rhubarb, in a drippingly soppy way, the dog will be pleased. This is Lucy Kellaway for the BBC World Service.
Well, we've had lots of reaction to Lucy's piece from last week about having her handbag stolen. Richard Hall of London says she almost sounds chuffed with the fact that four hunky firemen drove to her offices to remove the lock from her bike, as she claimed she had no money for a locksmith. Borrow some, he says. And John Warwick from California says, Lucy Kellaway's style is smug and your programme is not improved by it. Miss Kellaway's narratives always seem to adulate underperformance, he says. Is she trying to put us in touch with our second best? Lucy, your primal shortcomings are no less hideous because you wave them at us. Ouch. Well, do keep in touch through our website, bbcworldservice.com.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Mickey Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Cohen. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.